Peace and love. Peace and love.
Welcome to this neighborhood, neighbor.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
You know what I am? I'm a housewife that figured it out.
Wow, 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 wow!
And now, here's the host of Good Things Radio, Brooke Taylor.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Good Things Radio. My name is Brooke Taylor, a housewife who has not figured it out. This is episode number 154, and today we interrupt your regularly scheduled program to bring you a very special guest who is going to, money back guarantee, inspire you, enlighten you, surprise you, I think, as well. If you were able to sit across the table and have coffee with a world-renowned expert on the life of Jesus Christ, on early Judaism, on archaeology and ancient Palestine, what would you ask? What would you want to know? This is your moment. So that was my challenge. I can only hope that some of the questions that I asked may be things that you're wondering about too. And the expert that I'm talking about on today's show is the president of the Archaeological Institute of America, the Kenyon Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and one of my intellectual heroes. That's Dr. Jody Magnus. So I happen to be, just so you know how this came to be, an avid listener of lectures by the teaching company for probably the last 10 years. And basically how it works is you're taken into these classrooms of the most esteemed, distinguished professors as they deliver lectures to mostly non-academics like myself. So Dr. Magnus is a favorite of mine. One of the things that I think, though, makes these scholars so good is that they're able to take these really complicated concepts that are bewildering otherwise and somehow communicate the ideas in easy-to-understand ways, which is amazing when you're able to do that. I mean, to be engaging about a topic like metaphysics or explaining the difference between the Goths and the Visigoths, it's not easy, at least for someone like me to follow. So that's why I love these professors so much and how they bring these topics to life. We all know, or at least I hope we do, the power of one amazing teacher in our lives. In fact, Jody's going to talk about that as well, but the impact that a really, really good teacher can make. And on today's show, we get Dr. Magnus all to ourselves for a few minutes. And so for me personally, having listened to so many of her lectures, this is one of the most exciting guests that we've ever had on the program, for me just being such a big fan. But I also have a confession to make about this segment. So I knew when I connected with Jody and she said, yes, that she would have some time to be on the show that I needed. There are just some segments, some guests, some topics that you know you need to intensely prep for. And with all that she covers, somehow I needed to keep it relatively simple because we have a limited time frame as we cover one of the most complex regions in the world. So in my mind, I'm thinking I need to prep big time for this. And I was thinking about it every day for like a week, thinking about questions. I also had a busy schedule, was traveling, juggling things with kids, the family. So I wrote down on the calendar our interview time, the day, and then the day before I was expecting to talk to Dr. Magnus, she calls when I'm at the grocery store. And I wasn't ready. I had the wrong day. I hadn't written down any questions. And so, of course, I was thinking, I blew it and I mess up the date and I'm not ready. And Radio Prep 101 is always be ready for the mic to be live, always be ready to be prepared. So I'm sharing this with you so that as you listen to the interview, you kind of know what was going on behind the scenes. She graciously fit me in. But without a Skype connection, we had to capture the audio that you'll hear using Google Talk. And so you're going to notice that the connection isn't the most clear. It isn't perfect. And I was also hiding in my closet under my clothes rack for acoustic's sake. At one point, Caroline is banging on the door because it was literally 5 o'clock. So we've got supper going on, kids coming in, kids needing to find shoes and get things for what was going on in the evening. So you may or may not hear that in the background. I hope you don't, but that's kind of what's happening as the backstory. I mean, and the only way that I can describe it to you is to say, like, say
if you could sing with anybody on stage, who would it be? Like Taylor Swift, the Judds, Matt Maher? I mean, think about that. So say you are at this concert and the artist that you've loved and dreamed about singing with is inviting you on stage. And then your moment comes and you're up there and like your voice cracks like Peter Brady or something goes wrong. And so it's just not how you pictured it, you know. But for Dr. Magnus's part, she was on point. She was as amazing as ever. And that's what I think that you're going to love. So if you can, take a break, grab some coffee, listen to the incredible insights that she has to share about Jesus, Jerusalem, holy sites, and so much more, just to kind of take a little armchair pilgrimage. As we jump in, a little bit about Dr. Magnus. She is the Keenan Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism at the University of Chapel Hill, an archaeologist with extensive field experience, and as I mentioned, the president of the Archaeological Institute of America. She's published 10 books, including The Archaeology of the Holy Land, dozens of articles, also has a new book in the works about Masada, which we will touch on. Dr. Magnus specializes in archaeology of ancient Palestine, which today is modern Israel, Jordan, the Palestinian territories, in the Roman, Byzantine, and early Islamic periods. Her research interests include Jerusalem, Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, ancient synagogues, Masada, and ancient pottery. I mean, the corpus of her work is staggering. So it's exciting to bring her here on the show to you today. Please welcome Dr. Jody Magnus.
Well, thank you for having me. Do you realize what a hero you are to the average mortal mom like me? I am so grateful for your work and that you're with us today. It's funny because at one point as I was prepping for this interview, I just kind of threw my hands up because I knew there would be no way that we would be able to cover the topics that you speak about. So we're just going to keep it simple. Is that okay today?
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks.
So as we start out, I just would love to know personally what it was in you that first prompted a zeal for learning, for archaeology, particularly the disciplines you study.
Well, I wanted to be an archaeologist since I was 12. What happened was when I was in seventh grade, I had a really good history teacher, and we did world history that year, and I fell in love with ancient Greece. And at the same time, I was going to Girl Scout camp and finding fossils of shells, and I had the usual childhood fascination with dinosaurs. And it all just kind of came together, and I decided I wanted to be an archaeologist, and I was interested ever since then in the classical world. So that's all I've ever done.
It seems so exciting. I remember in second grade learning about ancient Egypt and the pyramids and thinking, this is it. And I know also growing up in an era of Indiana Jones, you think, yes, it's exciting.
Right.
This is my calling. But I know it's a lot of also digging through dirt and sand. But you've also had some pretty amazing moments. I was wondering if you could maybe just cherry pick a few of the more riveting discoveries that you've been in the field to appreciate.
Well, you know, that's always like asking a parent to choose their favorite child.
That's hard.
Yeah, but I think that without a doubt, the most exciting thing I've ever done or worked on or found is my current dig, which is at Hukok in Israel's Galilee. It was an ancient Jewish village in the Roman and Byzantine periods, and we are bringing to light a monumental synagogue building decorated with the most extraordinary mosaic floors with biblical scenes, and it's just amazing. So every year it just gets better and better and more exciting. So that's definitely got to be, you know, at the top.
So paint the picture then, time-wise, this is after the death of Christ?
That's right. So we're about 400 years after the time of Jesus. What's interesting about that in terms of the context is it's a period when these Jewish communities were living under Christian rule because the Roman Empire had become a Christian empire by this time. And there's kind of a perception among many of my colleagues that Jewish settlement declined in this period because Christian rule was oppressive to Jews. But what we see in our village and in our synagogue is quite the opposite, a community that flourished and prospered under Christian rule.
Mm. Well, as you're speaking, it's interesting because having gone there just one time, my first visit was last year. Similarly, I guess, to Rome or any ancient city, it's that contrast between the ancient, these riveting monuments, and also the hustle and bustle of the modern world,
that is just a rush for the senses. And so
yeah.
I guess if you were to describe the Holy Land in one sentence, I know this is hard, if you could describe the Holy Land in one sentence, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know. How can I boil that down?
I don't know if it's possible.
I actually think the one word that would describe it is complex, right? But I think that the Middle East in general has been complex over time, no less so today than in ancient times. And I firmly believe that nobody can understand the modern Middle East without understanding the history of the region. So I think archaeology plays a very important role in that.
Absolutely. I had a chance, I guess like an armchair pilgrimage, to see you. It was an IMAX film called Jerusalem, and you were featured. You were talking about, it was really amazing. So you know, I mean, you know the dirt, you know the details and the history. What should people know about the city that maybe they don't? And I know that's a really hard, maybe a better way to phrase it is, what discoveries hold the most intrigue for you personally? What site?
Well, again, that's sort of like asking a parent to choose a favorite child, but I do think that, at least for your listeners maybe, one of the most interesting places I always think is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which, of course, is venerated by many, not all, but by many Christians around the world as the spot where Jesus was crucified and laid to rest in a tomb. And it's a really interesting building from an archaeological and historical perspective because it has a complex history. It was built and then destroyed and rebuilt, and so you see all these different remains incorporated into it. But also in terms of its modern history, it's very interesting because there are different Christian groups and denominations that have control over different parts of the building, and they each have their own customs and their own liturgies, their own distinctive liturgical vestments. And it's just a fascinating place. And then it's always mobbed with pilgrims coming from many different parts of the world. So I just find that to be a really interesting building and a really interesting experience overall.
I agree. We had the producer of a film on about Mark Twain and his visit to the Holy Land and his girlfriend, and they made a movie, it's really, really good, a documentary, but he was questioning all the places that we were going that are in the Holy Land, and was this really the place? Is the accuracy really, after all these years, able to be pinpointed? And he surmised, well, at least Golgotha could, you know, that early on so many people would pilgrimage there and venerate the spot, that it had to at least be close. Would you agree with that?
Maybe. So the problem is that the church itself was built on that spot by Constantine in the early 4th century. Constantine was the very first Christian emperor. He's the one who legalized Christianity. And so it's actually one of the earliest churches that we have, period, because before the time of Constantine, Christianity was any legal outlawed religion in the Roman Empire. Christians could not worship openly, so we don't have churches before the time of Constantine in the Roman Empire. So the earliest churches we have go back to the time of Constantine, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is one of them, which means it goes back as far as you can go in Christian tradition. The problem is that there's still a 300-year gap between the time of Jesus and the time of Constantine. So what we can say is that by the time of Constantine, that site was worshipped by the local Christian community, apparently, as the spot where Jesus was crucified and buried. And since that's as far back as we can go in Christian tradition, many scholars believe then that it likely is the spot. But the problem is there's no way to verify that with a certainty. Now, the other little twist is that on that spot, there actually is an ancient cemetery from the time of Jesus, that is archaeological remains of a cemetery that dates to, let's say, the first century. So the importance of that is it means that that spot was located outside the walls of the city in the time of Jesus, because Jews buried their dead outside the walls of the city in the time of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And, of course, according to the gospel accounts, Jesus was led out through a gate in the wall of the city and crucified outside the walls of the city. So that is like a little piece of possible archaeological support for the authenticity of the location. But it's still, there's still no way scientifically to verify that Jesus' body was actually laid in one of the graves in that cemetery, in one of the tombs there. So that's about as good as it gets.
So how accurate then, I mean, I'm thinking about when you're saying this, I'm thinking about Gethsemane and Via Dolorosa. I'm thinking about him coming down for Palm Sunday.
Right.
These are significant signposts. So it's more, it sounds like, symbolic, as opposed to provable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Gethsemane is interesting. There is the Mount of Olives that's a feature of Jerusalem, and it overlooks the city, and there is, in fact, it's called Gethsemane because of the olive presses and the olive trees on the slopes. Whether the events that are documented in the gospel accounts actually occurred in that setting, again, there's no way archaeologically to verify that or not. We can say that the setting is accurate. That doesn't mean the story is accurate or the events occurred or that they occurred the way they're told. As far as the Via Dolorosa goes, that's a whole other thing, and I have like a whole lecture on that, because the Via Dolorosa that is walked today is not correct. I think we can say that with a fair degree of certainty, because the Via Dolorosa today starts to the north of the Temple Mount, at the northwest corner of the Temple Mount where Herod's Antonia Fortress was, and ends up at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And the reason is because modern Christian tradition has come to identify Herod's Antonia Fortress as the spot where Pontius Pilate sentenced Jesus to death. But in fact, Pontius Pilate, the praetorium, right, where Pontius Pilate would have sentenced Jesus to death, almost certainly would not have been located in the Antonia Fortress. It would have been located in the palace that Pontius Pilate would have lived in when he was in Jerusalem, which was Herod's old palace, which is on the other side of the city. So the entire Via Dolorosa, the route of it today, is incorrect. We need to reroute it in a completely opposite manner. And we know that through time there have been different lines of Via Dolorosa that have been walked by pilgrims through the streets of Jerusalem. And the current Via Dolorosa is a relatively late tradition in Jerusalem's history.
Wow, okay. So I know it's so hard for me as a layperson to keep track of the changes, but I think it's so important that we know that we go in recognizing that. And and I'm trying to enter into, because I think what it comes down to for Christians is you want to become closer to the historical, presupposing there was, and we're going to start from that foundation, a historical man named Jesus Christ, where we are more able to see the life, because his life obviously is so different than our own. And so I guess, and it's one of, speaking of lectures, it's one of my favorites that you do. You have with the Great Courses, the teaching company, it's Jesus and his Jewish influences. So I love the timelessness of that, because I guess I want to know some of those basic things. Did he wear a tunic? Did he have a beard? Because those historical things, you know about Jewish men in the time of Christ. Did he brush his teeth and bathe regularly? What are some everyday things that you could kind of share with us to illuminate the life of Christ?
Yeah, it's interesting. So first of all, I will agree with your baseline that there was a historical man named Jesus. And what is, I think, the most important thing to remember is that he lived his life as a Jewish man in that period.
And I
think that although many Christians today, they sort of pay lip service and say, yes, of course, Jesus was a Jew, I don't think many have actually internalized what that means in terms of his life, his worldview, his beliefs, his practices. And so, for example, there tends to be a kind of, I think, anachronistic common view that Jesus somehow rejected the temple and rejected the observance of the law, meaning the laws in the five books of Moses, which is absolutely not the case. He may, like some other Jewish groups like the Essenes, for example, have criticized the way that the priests were running the temple. He may have objected to certain practices, but he certainly took for granted that all Jews interacted with the God of Israel through the temple, that the temple was the place where the God of Israel dwelled, and that, like other Jews, in order to worship the God of Israel, you had to follow his laws. What Jews disagreed about, and even until today disagree about, is how to correctly interpret and observe those laws. But that's not saying that there shouldn't be laws or that you reject them. So I do think that it's really important to, if you are interested in sort of understanding Jesus at more than just a really, you know, strictly speaking, spiritual level, but you want to sort of understand where he was coming from, to put him in that Jewish context.
As you mentioned the Essenes, I had heard, this is something I never heard about growing up. I'd never even heard the Essenes, that sect at all. And then
right.
hearing, well, could Jesus have been an Essene, this more austere sect? And, okay, because I know that kind of ties in. I mean, I know it does. It ties into Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Could you give us, you know, a quick snapshot for someone listening who said, I don't even know about this. What is that and what's that all about?
Right. Well, so basically in the time of Jesus, so we're now talking 1st century B.C., 1st century A.D., what we call in Jewish history the late Second Temple period. So in this period, there were many different Jewish groups and movements. They're sometimes called sects. But your listeners should bear in mind that the term sect in this period doesn't have the pejorative sense that it has today. And just like now, there was always a diversity among Jews, right? They always disagreed with each other about how to worship properly, what to, you know, follow the law and all of that. And so it was also 2,000 years ago. And we know about some of these groups, and we know more about some of them than we do about others. So the main groups that we hear about from our literary sources, which include, by the way, the New Testament, are the Pharisees and the Sadducees, right? So the Pharisees mm-hmm. are the group that eventually morph into the rabbis after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Sadducees are basically the Jerusalem elite, so like the high priestly families and people like that. But we also have another group called the Essenes, and they are a kind of a fringe group that was more marginal and less numerous than the Pharisees and Sadducees. And they're the ones who deposited the scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the caves around the site of Qumran by the Dead Sea. And all of these groups are Jewish. They all agree that you have to follow the law. They all worship the God of Israel, but they disagree on specific points of interpretation of the law. And generally speaking, the Essenes were stricter in their interpretation than everybody else. That's more or less the thing that characterizes them. Now, so was Jesus an Essene? So if you go online, you actually will find a lot of websites that say Jesus was an Essene. It's true that there are some similarities between Jesus and the Essenes, just as if you take any two of these Jewish groups, there will be some similarities between them. But what is important is not the similarities, but the differences. So the similarities, by the way, include an apocalyptic outlook, because Jesus and his movement and the Essenes were both groups that believed that the end of days was either imminent or already underway, and therefore they had an apocalyptic outlook. And this makes them look somewhat similar in some ways. But they're also very, very different. So the Essenes constituted their group as a substitute, a sort of a substitute temple or desert tabernacle. Every full member of the group lived his life like he was a priest in the Jerusalem temple and therefore observed Jewish purity laws at the highest level possible. If we take the gospel account seriously, Jesus did not do that. In fact, if we look at the gospel accounts and take them seriously, Jesus was not particularly concerned with a very high level of purity observance. He came into contact with members of Jewish society who were ritually impure, like women with a hemorrhage or lepers or even corpses. Mm-hmm. So there's a very, very big difference in the approach of Jesus's movement on the one hand and the Essenes on the other to the observance of ritual purity laws. And I want to make it clear, they did, even Jesus observed ritual purity laws, but it's a question of to what degree do you observe them and in what context you observe them. And so there's a big difference there. There's another big difference in their basic outlook towards inclusivity and exclusivity. The Essenes were an exclusive movement. Very few people were eligible to even apply for full membership. You had to be an unblemished adult Jewish man to be admitted as a full member, to even apply. To be admitted as a full member, unblemished meaning you had to be physically and mentally perfect. You couldn't have any handicaps or disabilities, which were the same criteria used for Jewish men serving in the Jerusalem temple. So only unblemished adult Jewish men could serve as priests in the Jerusalem temple, and the same criteria applied for admission for full membership to the Essene sect. Whereas, again, if we take the gospel account seriously, Jesus's outlook was quite the opposite. He was inclusive, and he welcomed everyone uh-huh. into his movement. So make no mistake, despite some similarities between them, there are fundamental differences, and there's no way that Jesus was an Essene.
Wow. Well, that's a powerful case, I think. Case closed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such an interesting study. I remember going to Qumran and seeing the site and even someone saying, well, I think John the Baptist may have visited, or, you know, there's just so much, some conjecture, some myth and legend. And I mean, it's no wonder it's captivating, but I think when you're speaking truth, too, it can also be quite overwhelming.
Yeah, for sure. To be fair, there, you know, John the Baptist is one figure who we hear about in the pages of the New Testament who might have had some sort of direct connection with the Essenes, because, you know, if we, again, take the gospel account seriously, John was from a priest family, was active in the area near Qumran at the time the site existed. He lived a very sort of ascetic, simple lifestyle, which is like the Qumran sect did, and
right.
he placed a great importance on immersion in water, which also the Essenes did because of their purity practices. But there are also differences. For example, John's diet was locusts and honey, according to the New Testament, whereas the Essenes had their own special food and drink that they prepared for themselves. John's clothing was camel hair, camel wool, which is very rough, very coarse. The Essenes wore, full members of the Essenes wore linen, which is what the priests wore, so they imitated what the priests did. And John's theology of baptism, of immersion in water, is different from what we read about in the Dead Sea Scrolls with regard to the Essenes. So it is possible that John had some contact with the people at Qumran, with the Essenes. It's possible even to speculate that he might have been a member of the sect at some point in his life. But what I always tell people is that even if that is the case, by the time we read about him and his activities in the pages of the New Testament, he was no longer a member of that sect.
Okay. Fascinating kind of rabbit trail, though. I mean, not something that you hear a whole lot about.
Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting to study more. I'm having to use all my self-mastery skills to wrap up to my final few questions because there's so many other areas that I'm thinking about. But I wanted to ask you, as someone for myself who visited the Holy Land for the very first time last year and trying to articulate my experience, we're going back again, and I find people are reserved, they're afraid or unsure. I'm wondering, because I know that you're drawn there, obviously, for historical reasons and work, but what would you tell people about the appeal of Israel and why it's so fascinating?
I think there are two questions. So first of all, the question of people being afraid to go over. And what I always tell people is, I tell them several things. I say, first of all, if you're waiting to go to the Middle East, to go to Israel specifically, don't wait for peace to break out because you'll never get there. But the fact is that unless, God forbid, there's an all-out war going on, Israel's actually a very safe place to visit. And I take students with me every summer to work there, and it's actually quite, it's very safe, and it's actually much safer in many ways than many places in the United States are these days. So
yeah.
As far as the safety issue goes, I have no hesitation in recommending to people to go. But as far as why it's so fascinating, it's because of the mixture of, you know, religion, archaeology, history, politics, modern and ancient. It's all mixed up there. It's all mixed up in a very small area. Kind of like, you know, it's like this pot that you have everything in and it's all boiling together. And it's fascinating. So you just see the mixture of everything together. No matter what you're interested in, whether you're interested in ancient times or modern times or religion or politics or whatever, there's something, I think, for everybody there.
Yes, I think there's not one day that's gone by that I haven't revisited a place in my mind because it's so outside of at least my little radius where I go, and it just captivates
right.
you. So it is. I guess one, it's kind of a personal question, but in speaking to friends and, you know, scholar friends that I have, professors and researchers, I always just marvel at their acumen and the breadth of knowledge that they have. And I remember a friend of mine saying, you know, it's actually sometimes not the best thing to have so much information. Sometimes it makes you doubt, it makes you question. And I'm just curious about the 12-year-old Jody and all that you've learned and seen and experienced. Has it changed your understanding of faith? Has it shaken what you believe? Has it affirmed what you've ever thought?
Neither. I don't know how to explain this, but it's a purely academic interest. I have no
okay.
no faith or beliefs or anything invested in any of this. It's just a scientific academic interest, and I consider myself a scientist, and I consider the material to be fascinating, but it has no relationship to anything in the way of personal. I mean, I have personal beliefs about scholarly integrity, right, and the right way to do scholarship and interpret it and present it, but it has nothing to do with any personal faith or, you know, religious beliefs or anything like that.
So you never got into this, which I assume to be true anyway, to say I'm going to try the case this way or that
no.
way, whether it's Judaism or, you know, nothing.
No,
it's
not at all.
For the
no.
pursuit of knowledge. And bringing that knowledge. I just think it's beautiful. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Masada because that was, you know, I know you have a whole lecture series on that too. But I at least want
and
to.
And I have a book coming out on Masada.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a book coming out. It'll be out hopefully in May with Princeton University Press, and it's going to be a trade book, meaning it's aimed at, you know, people like you, a non-academic, non-specialist audience that is just interested, right? So keep your eyes out for that.
The only thing I've seen written on Masada is Josephus. So, and I'm sure there's been other things, but I think it's time to be other really good books for, you know, that is accessible for everybody. So when did you say this will be out?
They're projecting May. So May 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It is fascinating, and your work is so important. If we want to find out more, I know you do travel and you give lectures. Can people find you online?
Yeah, I have a website. It's just myname.org, so jodymagnus.org.
Well, keep us posted on your dig in near Galilee.
Yeah. Well, also, we have a dig website, and people can visit that and keep up to date. That's hukoke.org. So hukoke, which sounds really weird, is spelled hukoq.org.
Okay.
And so that's the best way to keep up on what we're doing there.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much again for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Join the show. Share your feedback on Voxer. Find Brooke at BrookeTaylor1 or shoot us an email at feedback@goodthingsradio.com and be part of the conversation.
Thank you again, Dr. Magnus. Wouldn't you love to be on a dig with her? That would be so cool to be one of the students. Just fascinating insights and a lot to think about. And I think for me, there were so many follow-up questions that I thought of after we got off the phone. And even in the conversation, like about the accuracy of the holy sites, when she was talking about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I wanted to ask, what about written tradition, oral tradition, the evidence there? And then jumping to when she was talking about Hukoke and the discoveries, I want to know more about the Jewish-Christian relations, dig deeper, pardon the pun, but to get more of the layers. And so I know in just the little time we had, that was just the beginning, but I hope that you found it as fascinating as I did, and that it will evince us all to learn more about the historical Jesus. And when I talk about the Holy Land, and I've said it over and over, it's probably one of the most used phrases that I say when I speak about the Holy Land. It's that quote from Father Bargiel Pixner, and he says, I'm reading it, 5 Gospels record the life of Jesus. 4 you will find in books, 1 you will find in the land they call holy. Read the 5th Gospel, and the world of the 4 will be open to you. I think those words are undisputable. And having gone there, I realize them and understand them more than I would have and did before. And he himself, Father Bargiel, was an archaeologist. He came to know Christ in such a personal way through the terrain Jesus inhabited. He lived in Jerusalem. So, of course, as we close the show, I want to invite you again on this amazing voyage, this pilgrimage that will set sail. Not literally. We're not doing the Mark Twain version. It's going to be much faster. But to come along, to join and pilgrimage with us at the beginning of Lent 2019, really exciting to be there in Jerusalem on Ash Wednesday. And Brother John Michael Paul and I together headed to the Holy Land March 2nd through the 12th of next year. So I'll link up all the details. You can find the information in the show notes. Would love to have you. And I can't wait to go back. I think, like, if you see me daydreaming, that's probably what I'm thinking about while my phone is ringing and I'm missing an interview likely at the same time. So thank you again to Dr. Jody Magnus. If you want to find out more about her, her website is her name, Jodimag, NESS.com, and I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Coming up on our next show, kids and growing up. This is so hard. I don't even know how I'm going to get through all of them. My oldest has committed to a decision that has set the course for his life for the next several years. And I'm just kind of experiencing some new emotions over here. I'm okay. So I'm navigating that through prayer. We're going to talk about it. I want to share what it is. It's something that I think I referenced maybe once, but now we're official, and to unpack that. And a friend of mine also coming up on the next show, he has a new video series out that I think you're going to like. It's free. It's on YouTube. And it was just announced this week. You may have heard about it already. He will tell you who it is going to be on the show, and will tell us about it on episode number 155. A big thank you to my producer, Mark Cumming, for his dynamic skills and quick work. He is a producer extraordinaire, so for any production needs you may have, check him out at cumminghomestudio.com. Until next time, friends, peace and love. God bless you.